the fat servant, Matelote. "Let the palace doors be opened. Let everyone belong to the Académie Française and have the right to kiss Madame Hucheloup. Let's drink to that." Then he turned toward Ma Hucheloup and added, "Antique woman, consecrated by use, approach, that I may contemplate you." And Julie shouted, "Batelote and Bibelote, don't give Grantaire any more to drink. He spends crazy amounts of money. Since this morning he's already eaten up 2 francs 95 centimes in desperate extravagance." Grantaire went on, "Who the hell took the stars down without my permission, only to put them on again, this time disguised as candles?" Bossuet, completely plastered, had kept his cool. He had gone and sat on the sill of the open window, getting his back wet with the falling rain, and he contemplated his two friends. All of a sudden he heard a racket behind him, the sound of running, cries of "To arms!" He turned round and saw, in the Rue Saint-Denis, at the end of the Rue de la Chanvrerie, Enjolras flying past, musket in hand, and Gavroche with his pistol, Feuilly with his sabre, Courfeyrac with his sword, Jean Prouvaire with his carbine, Combeferre with his musket, Bahorel with his rifle, and the whole stormy armed mob that followed them. The Rue de la Chanvrerie was scarcely as long as the range of a rifle. Bossuet improvised a megaphone with both hands cupped around his mouth and shouted, "Courfeyrac! Courfeyrac! Ahoy there!" Courfeyrac heard the call, spotted Bossuet, and took a few steps into the Rue de la Chanvrerie, shouting a "What do you want?" that got crossed on the way with a "Where are you going?" "To make a barricade," answered Courfeyrac. "Why not here? This is the place for it. Make one here." "You're right, Legle," said Courfeyrac. And at a sign from Courfeyrac, the mob rushed into the Rue de la Chanvrerie. Night begins to fall on Grantaire. The place was in fact exactly right, with its funnel-shaped entrance from the street tapering at the bottom and ending in a dead end, where the current caused a bottleneck, the Rue Mondétour easily blocked off both left and right, and no attack possible except via the Rue Saint-Denis, that is, from the front and without cover. Bossuet on the Terps had the sure eye of Hannibal on the wagon. At the eruption of the gathering, horror took hold of the whole street. There was not a passerby who did not rapidly slip away. In a flash, from one end to the other, left, right, and center, shops, stalls, alleyway gates, windows, Persian blinds, attics, shutters of all shapes and sizes were slammed shut from the ground floor to the rooftops. A frightened old woman had even stuck a mattress in front of her window on 2 clothesline poles to cushion the musketry. The tavern was the only place open, and that for the good reason that that is where the crowd had rushed to.
"Oh, my God, oh, my God," sighed Ma Hucheloup.
Bossuet had gone down to meet Courfeyrac. Jolie, who had run to the window, shouted, "Courfeyrac, you should have grabbed an umbrella. You're going to catch a cold." Meanwhile, in a matter of minutes, 20 iron bars had been ripped off the grate over the shop front of the tavern, 20 yards of pavement had been ripped up, Gavroche and Bahorel had seized and tipped over the narrow dray of a lime manufacturer named Anceau, this dray containing 3 barrels full of lime, which they stashed under the piles of cobblestones. Enjolras had lifted up the trapdoor to the cellar, and all the widow Hucheloup's empty kegs had gone to flank the barrels of lime. Feuilly, with his fingers accustomed to colouring the delicate blades of fans, had buttressed the barrels and the dray with 2 massive piles of rubble. Rubble, improvised, like everything else, obtained who knows where. Wooden support beams had been ripped off the front of a neighbouring house and laid over the kegs. When Bossuet and Courfeyrac turned round, half the street was already barricaded with a rampart taller than a man. There is nothing like the hand of the people when it comes to throwing up by tearing down. Matelote and Gibelotte had joined the workers. Gibelotte came and went, loaded with debris. Her weariness was a help to the barricade. She served up cobblestones the way she would serve wine, looking half asleep. An omnibus drawn by 2 white horses went past at the end of the street. Bossuet bounded over the pavement, ran, stopped the driver, made the passengers get down, gave his hand to the ladies, sent the conductor packing, and returned, leading carriage and horses by the bridle. "Omnibuses," he said, "do not pass by the Courant. Non licet omnibus adire Corinthum." A second later, the unhitched horses were wandering off down the Rue Mondétour
and the omnibus was lying on its side, completing the roadblock. Ma Yushlu, shattered, had taken refuge upstairs. Her eyes were glazed, and she looked around without seeing, crying very softly. Her cries of horror didn't dare come out of her throat.
"It's the end of the world," she muttered.
Joly planted a kiss on Ma Yushlu's fat, red, wrinkled neck, and said to Grantaire, "My friend, I've always considered a woman's neck to be an infinitely delicate thing." But Grantaire was climbing up to the highest reaches of the dithyramb. Matelote had gone back upstairs. Grantaire had grabbed her by the waist and pushed her toward the window with long peals of laughter. "Matelote is ugly," he yelled. "Matelote is a dream come true of ugliness. Matelote is a pipe dream. Here's the secret of her birth. One fine day, a Gothic Pygmalion, making cathedral gargoyles, fell in love with one of them, the most horrible one. He begged love to give her life, and Matelote was the result. Look at her, citizens. She has chrome-yellow hair like Titian's mistress, and she's a good girl. Take my word for it. She'll put up a good fight. Every good girl contains a hero. As for Mother Yushlu, she's a good old sort. Look at the mustache she's got. She inherited it from her husband. A real hussar, all right. She'll put up a fight, too. Between the two of them, they'll put fear into the place. Comrades, we will overthrow the government, true as it is that there are 15 intermediate acids between margaric acid and formic acid. Anyhow, I couldn't care less. Gentlemen, my father always detested me because I was no good at mathematics. I am only good at love and liberty. I am the unflappable Grantaire. Never having had money, I've never become accustomed to it, which means I've never missed it. But if I had been rich, no one else would have been poor. I'd have shown him, oh, if only good hearts had good big purses, how much better it would be. I can imagine Jesus Christ with Rothschild's fortune. How much good he'd do then. Kiss me, Matelote. You are so shy and sensual. You've got cheeks that cry out for a sister's kiss and lips that cry out for the kiss of a lover.
Shut up, you wine cask, said Courfeyrac.
Grantaire replied, I am Capitoul, municipal magistrate of Toulouse and master of flower games. Enjolras, who was standing on top of the roadblock, fusil in hand, lifted up his handsome, austere face. Enjolras, we know, had something of the Spartan and the Puritan. He would have died at Thermopylae with Leonidas, and would have burned Droide with Cromwell.
Grantaire, he shouted, go and sleep off the booze away from here. This is the place for intoxication, not drunkenness. Do not dishonor the barricade.
Those angry words had an incredible effect on Grantaire. He'd have sworn he'd just had a glass of cold water thrown in his face. He suddenly seemed sobered up. He sat down, leaned on a table near the window, looked at Enjolras with ineffable sweetness and said to him, You know, I believe in you. Go away. Let me sleep here.
Go and sleep somewhere else, yelled Enjolras.
But Grantaire kept gazing steadily at him with loving, troubled eyes, and he replied, Let me sleep here until I die. Enjolras gave him a disdainful glare. Grantaire, you are not capable of believing, thinking, wanting, living, or dying. Grantaire retorted in a grave voice, You'll see. He stammered out a few more unintelligible words, then his head fell heavily on the table. And as commonly happens in the second stage of inebriety, into which Enjolras had so rudely and brusquely pushed him, a moment later he was fast asleep. An attempt at consoling Widow Yushlu. Bahorel, in ecstasies over the barricade, cried, There's the street nicely cropped off for you. Doesn't it look splendid? Courfeyrac, helping to demolish the tavern all the while, sought to console the widow who owned it. Mother Yushlu, weren't you complaining just the other day that you'd been fined for breaking the law because Gibelotte had shaken a bedspread out your window?
Yes, my good Monsieur Courfeyrac. Oh, my God, are you going to put that table on your horrible pile, too? And as for the bedspread, and also for a flower pot that fell onto the street from an attic, the government took 100 francs off me in fines. Tell me that isn't an abomination.
Well, then, Mother Yushlu, we're avenging you. Mother Yushlu did not seem to much appreciate the benefit of this compensation they were getting for her. She was satisfied in the manner of the Arab woman who, having received a slap from her husband, went off to complain to her father, calling for vengeance, and saying, "Father, you owe my husband affront for affront." The father asked, "Which cheek did he slap?" "The left cheek." The father then slapped the right cheek and said, "Now you're happy. Go and tell your husband he slapped my daughter, but I slapped his wife." The rain had stopped. Recruits arrived. Under their smocks, workers had smuggled in a powder keg, a basket containing bottles of vitriol, two or three carnival torches, and a wicker basket full of Chinese paper lanterns, left over from the king's birthday, La Fête du Roi, which fête was quite recent, having taken place on the 1st of May. It was said that this ammunition came from a grocer named Pépin in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. They broke the only street lamp in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, the corresponding street lamp in the Rue Saint-Denis, and all the street lamps in the surrounding streets of Mondétour, du Cygne, des Prêcheurs, and de la Grande and de la Petite Truanderie. Enjolras, Combeferre, and Courfeyrac directed everything. Now, two barricades were under construction at the same time, both leaning against the house of Corinthe at right angles. The bigger of the two closed off the Rue de la Chanvrerie, the smaller closed off the Rue Mondétour on the Rue du Cygne side. This last barricade, which was extremely narrow, was built exclusively out of barrels and cobblestones. There were about 50 workers there, some 30 armed with muskets, for on their way over, they had borrowed wholesale from an armorer's shop. You could not get a more odd and motley crew. One had a short coat, a cavalry saber, and two horse pistols. Another was in shirt sleeves, with a round hat and a powder horn dangling at his side. A third had padded his chest with a breastplate of 9 sheets of grey packing paper and was armed with a saddler's awl. One of them cried, "Let's exterminate them to the last man and die on the point of our bayonets." This man had no bayonet. Another displayed over his greatcoat a leather cross belt and a cartridge pouch of the National Guard, the pouch cover adorned with this inscription in red wool, "Public Order." Plenty of fusils bearing the numbers of legions, not many hats, no cravats, lots of bare arms, a few pikes. Add to that all the different ages, all the different faces, little pallid young men, suntanned dock workers. All of them were rushing around frantically, and while they gave each other a hand, they talked about their prospects, how they would have help by 3 o'clock in the morning, how they were sure of one regiment, how Paris would rise up. Terrible words, delivered with a sort of cordial joviality. You'd have thought they were brothers, yet they did not know each other's names. The beautiful thing about great danger is that it brings out the fraternity of strangers. A fire had been lit in the kitchen, and they were melting down into a bullet mold pitchers, spoons, forks, all the cabaret's metalware, and drinking all the while. Caps and bits of buckshot lay around on the tables next to the glasses of wine. In the billiard room, Ma Hucheloup, Matelote, and Giblotte, variously changed by terror, one stupefied, one breathless, the third, now actually awake, were tearing up old dishcloths and making lint. 3 insurgents were helping them, 3 great strapping lads with long hair, beards, and moustaches, who were going through the cloth with the nimble fingers of laundry supervisors and throwing them into a flutter. The tall man that Courfeyrac, Combeferre and Enjolras had noticed the moment he approached the crowd at the corner of the Rue des Billettes was making himself useful working on the small barricade. Gavroche was working on the big one. As for the young man who had waited at Courfeyrac's place for him and had asked for Monsieur Marius, he had disappeared more or less at the same time the omnibus had been overturned. Gavroche, radiant and completely airborne, had taken on the job of keeping things moving. He came and went, climbed up, clambered down, climbed back up, bustled, sparkled. He seemed to be there to goad everyone else on. Was there something spurring him on? Yes, of course there was. His misery. Did he have wings? Yes, of course he did. His exhilaration. Gavroche was a human whirlwind. He was to be seen constantly. He was to be heard never-endingly. He filled the air, being everywhere at once. He was almost annoyingly ubiquitous. No let-up was possible with him around. The whole enormous barricade felt him on its rump. He vexed the loafers, roused the layabouts,
revived the weary, annoyed the reflective, cheered up some, kept others on their toes, stirred others to fury, got everyone going. He stung a student, bit into a worker. He landed, stopped, took off again, flying above the mayhem and the effort, leaping from one group to the next, babbling, buzzing, and harassing the whole team, a fly on the vast revolutionary coach. Perpetual motion was in his tiny arms and perpetual clamor in his tiny lungs.
"Go to it! More cobblestones, more barrels, more thingamies! Where can we find some, a sack of rubble to block up that hole for me? It's too small, this barricade of yours. It needs to be higher. Pile everything on, chuck everything on, toss everything on, break up the house. A barricade, it's child's play. Look, here's a glass door."
This made the workers snort. "A glass door? What do you want us to do with a glass door, Pipsqueak?"
"Hercules yourselves, are you?" retorted Gavroche. "A glass door is an excellent thing in a barricade. Doesn't stop it being attacked, but makes it harder to take. Haven't you ever snitched apples over a wall that's got the bottoms of glass bottles stuck on it, then? A glass door'll cut the corns off the feet of the National Guard when they try to climb up on the barricade. Crikey, glass is treacherous! Gosh, you haven't got unbridled imaginations, have you, my comrades?"
But what he was really furious about was his pistols not having a dog, a hammer. He went from one man to the next, demanding,
"A musket! I want a musket! Why won't anyone give me a musket?"
"A musket, you," said Combeferre.
"Listen," said Gavroche, "why not? I had one all right in 1830, when there was a bit of strife with Charles D."
Enjolras shrugged his shoulders. "When there are enough to go round, the men will start handing them out to boys." Gavroche spun around proudly and shot back,
"If you're killed before me, I'll take yours."
"Brat," said Enjolras.
"Novice," said Gavroche.
An elegant stray fop, strolling at the end of the street, became a diversion. Gavroche called out to him,
"Come and join us, young man. Aren't you going to do anything for this old homeland of ours, then?"
The fop fled. Preparations. The newspapers of the day that said the barricade in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, that almost impregnable structure, as they called it, reached a level as high as the second story, were mistaken. The fact is that it got no higher, on average, than 6 or 7 feet. It was built in such a way that the combatants could, at will, either disappear behind the barrier, or peer over it, or even scramble up on top of it by means of 4 rows of cobblestones laid on top of each other and arranged in tiers on the inside like a flight of steps. From the outside, the front of the barricade, composed of piles of cobblestones and barrels held together by beams and boards that interlocked with the wheels of Anceau's cart and the overturned omnibus, looked hideously tangled and impossible to get out of. But an exit big enough for a man to get through had been provided between the wall of the houses and the end of the barricade that was farthest away from the cabaret, so that there was a way out. The beam of the omnibus was set upright and held in place with ropes, and a red flag tied to this beam fluttered over the barricade. The little Mont des Tours barricade, hidden behind the tavern, could not be seen. The two barricades together formed a real redoubt. Enjolras and Courfeyrac had not seen fit to barricade the other end of the Rue Mont des Tours that offers a way to Les Halles through the Rue des Prêcheurs, no doubt wanting to preserve a possible connection with the outside, and having little fear of being attacked by the dangerous and difficult alleyway known as the Rue des Prêcheurs. Except for this passage remaining free, constituting what Folard, in his style of strategy, would have called an inner trench, and also taking into account the narrow exit provided on the Rue de la Chanvrerie, the inside of the barricade, where the tavern formed a salient angle, presented an irregular quadrilateral closed on all sides. There was a gap of about 20 feet between the main barrier and the tall houses that formed the back of the street, so you could say that the barricade backed onto those houses, which were all inhabited but sealed tight from top to bottom. All this labor was carried out without hindrance in under an hour, and without this handful of daring men seeing one fur cap or one bayonet emerge. The few bourgeois who still ventured into the Rue Saint-Denis at that point in the riot shot a glance down the Rue de la Chanvrerie, saw the barricade, and stepped lively on their way. When the two barricades were finished and the flag run up, a table was dragged out of the tavern, and Courfeyrac hopped up on this table. Enjolras brought over the square box, and Courfeyrac opened it. This box had been filled with cartridges. When they saw the cartridges, there was a shudder among the bravest and a moment of silence. Courfeyrac distributed them with a smile. Every man was issued with 30 cartridges. Many of them had powder and set about making more of them with the bullets that were being cast. As for the powder keg, it was on a table by itself near the door, kept in reserve. The long rappel that rolled throughout Paris went on and on, but in the end it was merely a monotonous background noise which they paid no further attention to. At times this noise moved away, at times it came closer, wavering mournfully. The muskets and carbines were loaded, all together, unhurriedly, with solemn gravity. Enjolras went and positioned 3 sentinels outside the barricades, one in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, the second in the Rue de Bréchure, the third at the corner of La Petite Truanderie. Then, with the barricades built, the posts assigned, the guns loaded, the scouts positioned, alone in these fearsome streets where no one walked any more, surrounded by these mute and seemingly dead houses where no human movement pulsed, enveloped in the darkling shadows of twilight, in the middle of this obscurity and this silence in which they could feel something indescribably tragic and terrifying advancing, isolated, armed, resolute and calm, they waited. While waiting. In those hours of waiting, what did they do? We have to tell you, since this is history. While the men were making cartridges and the women lint, while a large saucepan full of molten pewter and lead, destined for the bullet mold, was smoking on a burning stove, while the scouts were keeping watch over the barricades with their weapons on their arms, while Enjolras, whom nothing could distract, was watching over the scouts, Combeferre, Courfeyrac, Jean Prouvaire, Fuilly, Bossuet, Joly, Bahorel, and a few others besides, sought each other out and came together as in their most tranquil school days, when they would huddle together, chattering, and in a corner of the tavern that had been turned into a casemate, 2 feet from the redoubt they had put up, their primed and loaded carbines resting on the backs of their chairs, these beautiful young men, so near their final hour, began to recite a love poem. Which poem? This one. Do you remember our sweet life, when we were both so young, and our hearts had but one desire, to look good and be in love? When we added your age to mine, we did not have 40 years between us, and in our humble little home, everything, even winter, was spring to us. Beautiful days. Manuel was proud and wise. Paris sat down to sacred banquets. Foy launched thunder, and your corsage had a pin that I pricked myself on. Everyone looked at you. Lawyer without a cause, when I took you to the Prado to dine, you were so pretty, the roses seemed to me to gaze after you. I heard them say, how beautiful she is, how good she smells, what flowing hair. Under her cape she is hiding wings, her lovely bonnet is barely blooming. I wandered with you, squeezing your soft arm. Passers-by thought that charmed love had married in our happy couple the sweet month of April to gorgeous May. We lived hidden, happy, behind closed doors, devouring love, that lovely forbidden fruit. My mouth could not say a thing before already your heart answered. The Sorbonne was a country retreat where I adored you from morning to night. That's how a soul in love applies the tender card to the Quartier Latin. Oh, Place Maubert! Oh, Place Dauphine! When in our fresh springtime hovel you ran your arms over your fine legs, I could see a star at the back of the garret. I've read a lot of Plato, but none of it has stuck. Better than Malebranche and Lamennais, you showed me heavenly bounty in a flower you gave me. I obeyed you. You submitted to me. Oh, golden garret! To enfold you, to see you come and go at dawn in a chemise, gazing at your fresh face in your old mirror. And who, tell me, could lose the memory of those days of dawns and stars? of ribbons, of flowers, of gauze and worry, where love stutters in such charming argo. Our garden was a pot of tulips. You cloaked the window with a petticoat. I took the bowl of the clay pipe, and I gave you the japanned cup. And the great calamities that made us laugh. Your burned muff, your lost boa, and that dear portrait of the divine Shakespeare that we sold so we could eat at night. I was a beggar, you were charitable. I kissed your fresh round arms on the wing. Dante in folio served us as a table, to gaily munch through 100 chestnuts. The first time in my joyful hovel that I took a kiss from your fiery lips, when you went off disheveled and red, I stayed all pale and believed in God. Do you remember our endless happiness, and all those fichus that turned to rags? Oh, so many sighs from our hearts full of shadow soared up into the endless heavens. The hour, the place these memories of youth recalled, a few stars starting to twinkle in the sky, the funereal repose of those deserted streets, the imminence of the inexorable adventure gearing up, gave a pathetic charm to these lines murmured softly in the twilight by Jean Prouvaire, who, as we said before, was a very gentle poet. Meanwhile, a paper lantern had been lit at the little barricade, and at the big one, one of those wax torches you see at Mardi Gras, in front of the carriages loaded with masks heading for the Cotille. These torches, as we know, came from the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. The torch had been placed in a cage of cobblestones, closed on three sides to shelter it from the wind, and positioned so that all the light fell on the flag. The street and the barricade remained plunged in darkness, and nothing but the flag could be seen, wonderfully lit up as though by some enormous dimmed lantern. This light added to the scarlet of the flag an indescribably terrible crimson. The men recruited in the Rue des Billettes. Night had well and truly fallen, but nothing happened. All that could be heard was dim, muffled sounds and the odd volley of gunfire, but these were rare, not long sustained, and remote. This respite was dragging on, a sign that the government was taking its time and gathering its forces. These 50 men were expecting 60,000. Enjolras felt himself seized by that impatience that takes hold of the headstrong on the threshold of awe-inspiring events. He went to find Gavroche, who had settled into making cartridges in the downstairs room by the dubious light of two candles placed on the bar out of harm's way as a precaution due to the powder spread over the tables. The insurgents had also been careful not to light any light in the upstairs rooms. At that moment Gavroche was extremely preoccupied, though not exactly with his cartridges. The man from the Rue des Billettes had just come into the downstairs room and had taken a seat at the table farthest from the light. A large model infantry flintlock musket had fallen into his hands, and he held it between his knees. Until that moment, distracted by 100 amusing things, Gavroche had not even seen the man. When he came in, Gavroche followed him mechanically with his eyes, admiring his musket. Then, suddenly, just as the man sat down, the boy shot up. Anyone eyeing the man up to that point would have seen him taking everything in about the barricade and the band of insurgents with singular intensity. But from the moment he stepped into the barroom, he had fallen into a kind of meditative state and did not seem to see anything any more of what was going on. The kid went over to this pensive character and began circling around him on tiptoe, the way you walk when you're frightened of waking someone up. As he did so, his little boy's face, at once so cheeky and serious, so mobile and so deep, so chirpy and so harrowing, reproduced all the grimaces of an old man that signify, "Ah, bah, can't be, I'll be buggered, I must be seeing things, I must be dreaming. Can it be? No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not." And so on. Gavroche rocked on his heels, balled his two fists in his pockets, bobbed his head on his neck like a bird, put all the sagacity of his bottom lip into one enormous pout. He was dumbstruck, doubtful, incredulous, convinced, dazzled. He had the facial expression of the head eunuch at the slave market discovering a Venus among all the lumps of lard,
or the look of an amateur recognizing a Raphael in a stack of crummy paintings. Everything in him was at work, his instinct for sniffing out and his intellectual capacity for putting two and two together. It was obvious that something powerful was happening to Gavroche. It was at the peak of this preoccupation that Enjolras came up and spoke to him. "You're little," said Enjolras. "You won't be seen. Duck out of the barricades. Slip along the houses, ferret around the streets, and come back and tell me what's happening." Gavroche straightened up. "So little ones are good for something, eh? That's lucky. I'll go. Meanwhile, trust the little ones. Don't trust the big ones." Here Gavroche raised his head and lowered his voice and added, indicating the man from the Rue des Billettes, "You see that big one over there?" "What about him?" "He's a stool pigeon." "You sure?" "Not even a fortnight ago, he pulled me by the ear off the ledge of the Pont Royal where I was getting some fresh air." Enjolras swiftly left the kid and murmured a few words in a whisper to a laborer from the wine docks who happened to be there. The laborer left the room and came back almost immediately with three others. These four men, four broad-shouldered porters, went and positioned themselves behind the table where the man from the Rue des Billettes was leaning, without doing anything that might attract his attention. They were ready to throw themselves upon him. Enjolras then approached the man and asked him, "Who are you?" At this abrupt question, the man flinched. He looked Enjolras straight in his frank and open eyes and seemed to read what he was thinking there. He smiled a sneer of a smile that was the most disdainful, the most forceful, and the most resolute smile it was possible to smile, and he answered with arrogant gravity, "I see what you're up to. So then, yes. You're a spy?" "I am a government official." "What's your name?" "Javert." Enjolras signaled to the four men. In the twinkling of an eye, before Javert had time to turn round, he was collared, laid out, tied up, frisked. They found on him a small round card stuck between two bits of glass and bearing on one side the engraved coat of arms of France, with this legend, "Surveillance et Vigilance," and on the other, this information, "Javert, Inspector of Police, aged 52, and the signature of the Prefect of Police of the time, Monsieur Gisquet. On top of this, he had on him his watch and his purse, which contained a few gold coins. They let him keep his purse and his watch. Under the watch, at the bottom of his fob pocket, they felt around and found a piece of paper in an envelope that Enjolras opened. He read these lines, written in the prefect's very own handwriting: "As soon as his political mission has been fulfilled, Inspector Javert will ascertain, by special investigation, whether it is true that malefactors have rallying points on the slope of the right bank of the Seine, near the Pont d'Iéna." The search over, they lifted Javert back onto his feet, tied his arms behind his back, and bound him to that celebrated post that had once given the tavern its name, in the middle of the downstairs room. Gavroche, who had witnessed the whole scene and approved it all with a quiet nod of the head, went up to Javert and said, "Looks like the mouse caught the cat." All this was done so fast that it was over by the time anyone else in or around the tavern realized. Javert had not let out a single cry. But when they saw Javert tied to the post, Courfeyrac, Bossuet, Joly, Combeferre, and the men scattered about the two barricades came running. Javert had his back against the post and was so wound round with ropes that he couldn't move a muscle, yet he raised his head with the intrepid serenity of a man who has never lied. "He's a spy," said Enjolras, and he turned to Javert. "You'll be shot 2 minutes before the barricade is taken." Javert replied, in his most imperious tone, "Why not right away?" "We're saving our powder." "Well, you could get it over with a knife." "Spy," said the handsome Enjolras. "We are judges, not assassins." Then he called Gavroche. "You, get about your business. Go and do what I told you." "I'm going," cried Gavroche. But he paused on the way out. "By the way, you'll give me his musket." And he added, "I leave you the musician, but I want the clarinet." The kid gave a military salute and gaily bounded through the gap in the main barricade. Several question marks regarding a man named Le Cabuc, who was perhaps not Le Cabuc. The tragic picture we have begun to paint would not be complete. The reader would not see in their exact and actual relief these great moments of society in labor and giving birth to revolution
in which the convulsions are mixed with sheer hard work, if we leave out of the outline sketched here an incident full of epic and savage horror that occurred almost immediately after Gavroche left. Mobs, as we know, are like snowballs, and gather, as they roll, a heap of rowdy men. These men do not ask each other where they come from. Among the passers-by who attached themselves to the mob, led by Enjolras, Combeferre, and Courfeyrac, there was a man in a porter's jacket worn at the shoulders, who was gesticulating and vociferating and flailing his arms around for all the world like a crazy drunk. This man, going by the name or nickname of Le Cabuc, Fathead, and otherwise completely unknown to those who claimed to know him, who was extremely drunk or pretending to be, had sat down with a few others at a table they had dragged outside the cabaret. This Le Cabuc, all the while encouraging those who were with him to drink, looked to be studying most thoughtfully the big house at the back of the barricade, whose five stories dominated the whole street and faced the Rue Saint-Denis. Suddenly he shouted, "Comrades, you know what? We should shoot from that house there. When we're up there at the windows, I'll defy any bastard to come down the street." "Yes, but the house is shut up," said one of his drinking mates. "We'll knock." "They won't open. We'll break the door down." Le Cabuc runs to the door, which has an absolutely massive knocker, and knocks. The door does not open. He knocks a second time. No one answers. A third knock. Same silence. "Is anyone there?" cries Le Cabuc. Nothing stirs. So then he grabs a gun and begins bashing the door with the butt. It was an old alley door, arched, low, narrow, solid, all in oak, lined on the inside with sheet metal and an iron brace, a regular fortress door. The banging made the house shake, but did not shift the door. Yet it is likely that the inhabitants were roused, for a small square dormer window on the third floor was finally seen to light up and open, and an old man with gray hair was seen to appear at this window with a candle, open-mouthed and frightened-looking. It was the porter. The man hammering the door stopped.
"Monsieur," asked the porter, "what is it you want?"
"Open up," roared Le Cabuc.
"Monsieur, that can't be done."
"Open up right now."
"Impossible, monsieur."
Le Cabuc got his gun and took a bead on the porter's head. But as he was below and it was very dark, the porter didn't see him.
"Will you open up, yes or no?"
"No, monsieur."
"No, you say?"
"I say no, my good—"
The porter did not finish his sentence. The gun went off. The bullet entered just below his chin and exited at the back of his neck after cutting straight through the jugular. The old man slumped forward in a heap without a sigh. The candle fell and went out, and nothing more could be seen except an unmoving head sitting on the windowsill and a wisp of whitish smoke curling up toward the roof.
"That's that," said Le Cabuc,
letting the butt of his gun drop to the pavement again. Hardly had he uttered those words than he felt a hand land on his shoulder with the weight of an eagle's talons, and he heard a voice say to him, "On your knees!" The murderer turned and saw in front of him the cold, white face of Enjolras. Enjolras had a pistol in his hand. At the explosion he had come running. He had grabbed Le Cabuc's collar, smock, and braces in his left hand.
"On your knees," he repeated.
And with a sovereign movement, the frail young man of 20 pushed the stocky and robust picklock onto his knees in the mud, bending him like a reed. Le Cabuc tried to resist, but it was as though he'd been seized by a superhuman fist. Pale and wan, with his neck bare, his hair wild, his perfectly womanly face, Enjolras looked amazingly like the Themis of antiquity. His flaring nostrils and downcast eyes gave his implacable Greek profile that expression of fury and of chastity combined that, in the ancient world's view, belonged to justice. The whole barricade had come running, then all had lined up in a circle at a distance, feeling it impossible to utter a word in the face of what they were about to see. Le Cabuc, defeated, gave up trying to fight and trembled from head to foot. Enjolras let him go and took out his watch.
"Pull yourself together," he said. "Pray or reflect. You've got 1 minute."
"Mercy," murmured the murderer. Then he hung his head and stuttered out a few inarticulate oaths. Enjolras did not take his eyes off his watch. He let a minute pass, then he put the watch back in his fob pocket. That done, he grabbed Le Cabuc, who was curled over at his knees howling, by the hair and pressed the muzzle of his gun to his ear. Many of those intrepid men, who had embarked on the most frightening of adventures without turning a hair, now turned their heads away. They heard the explosion. The assassin hit the pavement face first, and Enjolras straightened up and ran his determined eagle eye around him. Then he pushed the dead body away with his foot and said, "Throw that outside." 3 men lifted up the body of the poor, miserable wretch, which was still juddering with the last mechanical convulsions of the life that had flown, and threw it over the small barricade into Mondétour alleyway. Enjolras remained lost in thought. It was hard to know what imposing shadows were slowly spreading over his awesome serenity. Suddenly he raised his voice. Everyone fell silent.
"Citizens," said Enjolras, "what that man did is horrifying, and what I did is horrible. He shot someone, and that is why I killed him. I had to do it, for an insurrection must be disciplined. Murder is even more of a crime here than elsewhere. We are under the eye of the revolution. We are the priests of the republic. We are the sacramental hosts of duty, and no one must be able to vilify our struggle. So I judged that man and sentenced him to death. As for myself, forced to do what I did, but abhorring it, I have judged myself as well, and you will soon see what I have sentenced myself to."
Those who were listening shuddered.
"We will share your fate," cried Combeferre. "So be it," Enjolras went on. "One other thing. In executing that man, I obeyed necessity. But necessity is a monster of the old world. Necessity is called fatality. Now, the law of progress has it that monsters disappear in the face of angels, and that fatality evaporates in the face of fraternity. This is a bad moment to utter the word love. Never mind, I utter it, and I glorify it. Love, you hold the future in your hands. Death, I use you, but I hate you. Citizens, in the future there will be no darkness, no thunderbolts, no vicious ignorance, no bloody eye for an eye, blood for blood. Since there will be no more Satan, there will be no more Michael. In the future, no one will kill anyone. The earth will shine. The human race will love. It will come, citizens. The day when all will be peace, harmony, light, joy, and life. It will come. And it is so that it comes that we are going to die."
Enjolras was silent, his virgin lips closed, and he remained for some time standing at the spot where he had spilled blood, as still as a marble statue. His staring eyes made everyone drop their voices around him. Jean Prouvaire and Combeferre quietly shook hands, and leaning on each other at the corner of the barricade, studied with an admiration that had a touch of compassion in it this grave young man, executioner and priest, made of light like crystal, and of rock, too. We should say right now that later, after the action, when the bodies were taken to the morgue and searched, a police officer's card was found on Le Cabuc. In 1848, the author of this book held in his own hands the special report on this subject made to the prefect of police in 1832. We should add that if we are to believe a strange but probably well-founded police tradition, Le Cabuc was Claquesous. The fact is that after the death of Le Cabuc, nothing more was ever heard of Claquesous. Claquesous left no trace of his disappearance. He seemed to have vanished into thin air. His life had been darkness. His end was invisible night. The whole group of insurgents was still in the grip of the emotion of this tragic trial, so quickly set up and so quickly ended, when Courfeyrac spotted in the barricade the young man who had been looking for Marius at his place that morning. This boy, who had a bold and reckless look, had come at night to join the insurgents. Book 13. Marius Steps into the Shadows. From the Rue Plumet to the Quartier Saint-Denis. The voice that had called Marius through the dying light to the barricade in the Rue de la Chanvrerie sounded to him like the voice of destiny. He wanted to die. The occasion presented itself. He knocked at heaven's door. A hand in the shadows held out the key to him. These dismal opportunities that open up in the darkness of despair are tempting. Marius pulled back the bolt that had let him pass through so many times, walked out of the garden, and said, "Let's go." mad with pain, no longer feeling anything steady or solid in his brain, incapable of accepting anything any more that fate had to offer after these 2 months spent in the intoxications of youth and of love, overwhelmed by all the visions of despair coming all at once, he had only one desire left, to end it all, fast. He started to step up his pace. It just so happened that he was armed, having Javert's pistols on him. The young man he thought he'd seen had vanished out of sight on the street. Marius had come from the Rue Plumet via the boulevard. He now crossed over the Esplanade and the Pont des Invalides, the Champs-Élysées, the Place Louis XV, and turned into the Rue de Rivoli. The shops were open, the gas was burning under the arcades, women were buying up in the boutiques, people were having ice cream in the Café Laité, they were eating little cakes in the English pastry shop. Only a few post-chaises were setting out at a gallop from the Hôtel des Princes and the Hôtel Meurice. Marius turned into the Rue Saint-Honoré via the Passage de l'Homme. The boutiques were closed, the merchants were chatting in front of their half-open doors, people were strolling around, the street lamps were lit, all the windows were lit from the first floor up, as usual. They were cavalry on the Place du Palais Royal. Marius followed the Rue Saint-Honoré. The farther away he got from the Palais Royal, the fewer lights there were in windows. The boutiques were completely closed. No one was chatting on their doorsteps. The street grew darker, and at the same time, the crowd grew denser. For the passers-by were now a crowd. No one was seen to speak in this crowd, and yet a deep, muffled hum was coming from it. Near the Fontaine de l'Arbre Sec, there were gatherings, motionless, gloomy groups standing amid the eddying hordes like stones in the middle of a running stream. At the mouth of the Rue des Prouvaires, the crowd had stopped moving. They formed a resistant block, massive, solid, compact, almost impenetrable, of people heaped together and talking in low voices. Black coats and round hats had virtually disappeared. Smock frocks, smocks, caps, bristling heads caked with dirt. This mob undulated confusedly in the nocturnal fog. Its whisperings had the harsh sound of sighing. Although not one person was moving, you could hear shuffling in the mud. Beyond this dense mass, in the Rue du Roule, in the Rue de Prouvaires, and in the extended part of the Rue Saint-Honoré, there was not a single window with a candle burning in it. In those streets, single files of solitary lanterns could be seen stretching away in thinning numbers. The lanterns of those days were like big red stars hanging from ropes and throwing shadows over the footpath in the shape of great spiders. Those streets were not deserted. You could make out stacks of muskets there, bayonets waving around, and troops bivouacking. Nobody curious stepped over that mark. There the traffic stopped. There the crowd ended, and the army began. Marius wheeled with the will of a man beyond all hope. He had been called. He had to go. He found a way of cutting through the crowd and cutting through the bivouac of troops, hiding from the patrols and avoiding the sentries. He took a detour, made it to the Rue du Bétisier, and headed for Les Halles. At the corner of the Rue de Bourdonnais, there were no more lanterns. After cutting through the crowd belt, he passed beyond the fringe of troops and found himself in a frightening place in the middle of something terrible. Not one person walking by, not one soldier, not one light. No one. Solitude. Silence. Night. A mysterious chill that bit to the bone. Going into a street was like going into a cellar. He continued on, tentatively. Someone ran right past him. Was it a man, a woman, several people? He could not have said. It had passed, and it had vanished. By a roundabout way, he came to a little street that he thought must be the Rue de la Poterie. About halfway along, he ran into an obstacle. He put his hands out. It was an overturned cart. His feet recognized puddles of water, potholes, scattered and piled up cobblestones. A barricade had been started there and then abandoned. He climbed up the cobblestones and found himself on the other side of the barrier. He walked along, sticking close to the curbstones and guiding himself by the walls of houses. A little beyond the barricade, he thought he caught a glimpse of something white up ahead. He approached. It took on a shape. It turned into two white horses, the horses of the omnibus unhitched that morning by Bossuet and who had wandered about willy-nilly from street to street the whole day, and had wound up stopping there, with the weary patience of brutes that don't understand the actions of men, any more than men understand the actions of Providence. Marius left the horses behind. As he came to a street that struck him as being the Rue du Contrat Social, a gunshot coming from who knows where and shooting across the darkness randomly whistled past him very close. The bullet went through a copper shaving dish hanging outside a hairdresser's shop. You could still see this shaving dish with a bullet hole in it in 1846, in the Rue du Contrat Social at the corner where the pillars of Les Halles stand. This gunshot meant life still. From that moment on, though, he didn't come across another thing. This whole excursion was like going down dark stairs. But that didn't stop Marius pressing ahead. Paris as the owl flies. Anyone who could have soared over Paris at that moment with the wings of a bat or an owl would have had a grim spectacle beneath their eyes. The whole of the old Les Halles quartier, which is like a city within a city, crossed by the Rue Saint-Denis and the Rue Saint-Martin, crisscrossed by a thousand little lanes, and which the insurgents had made their redoubt and their field of arms, would have appeared to them like an enormous black hole dug out in the center of Paris. There their gaze would have fallen into an abyss. Thanks to the broken street lamps, thanks to the windows shut tight, any beam of light, any life, any sound, any movement ceased there. The invisible riot police were watching everywhere and maintaining order, meaning darkness. To drown the smallness of their number in one vast obscurity, to beef up each combatant through the possibilities this obscurity offers. This is the essential tactic of insurrection. At nightfall, every window where a candle burned received a bullet. The light was put out, sometimes the inhabitant killed. And so nothing stirred. There was nothing there inside the houses but fear, mourning, stupor. In the streets, a sort of awestruck horror. You could not even see the long rows of windows and stories, the jagged lace of the chimneys and roofs, not even the dim reflections gleaming on the muddy, wet pavement. Any eye that could have looked down from above into that jumble of shadows might perhaps have glimpsed here and there, in places, indistinct lights bringing out the broken and bizarre lines and shapes of weird constructions. Something like ghostly glimmerings coming and going among ruins. That was where the barricades were. The rest was a lake of darkness, foggy, heavy, funereal, above which rose the motionless and gloomy silhouettes of the Tour Saint-Jacques, Saint-Marie Church, and two or three other of those great edifices man turns into giants and the night turns into phantoms. All around this deserted and ominous labyrinth, in the quartier where the Paris traffic had not been brought to a standstill, and where a few rare lamplights still shone, the aerial observer would have been able to make out the metallic scintillation of sabers and bayonets, the muffled rumbling of artillery, and the swarming of silent battalions swelling in number from one minute to the next, a daunting belt that slowly tightened and closed around the riot. The besieged quartier was now no more than a sort of monstrous cavern. Everything in it seemed to be asleep or motionless, and, as we have just seen, each of the streets offering access was now nothing but shadow. A fierce shadowland, full of traps, full of unknown and fearful things, where it was frightening to go and awful to stay, where those who went in shivered in the face of what was waiting for them there, where those who waited shuddered in the face of those who were about to come. Invisible combatants, entrenched at every street corner. Pitfalls of the grave hidden in the thick layers of the night. It was all over. No light to hope for from now on, other than the flash of guns. No encounter other than the sudden, swift appearance of death. Where? How? When? You did not know, only that it was certain and inevitable. There, in that place marked for battle, the government and the insurrection, the National Guard and the popular clubs, the bourgeoisie and the dissidents, were about to grope their way toward each other. For both sides, the essential requirement was the same, to come out of it slain or victorious, the only possible way out from that point on. Such an extreme situation, such powerful darkness, The most timid felt filled with resolution, and the most daring with terror. Add to this on both sides fury, relentlessness, equal determination. For one side, to advance meant to die, yet no one thought of turning back. For the other side, to stay meant to die, yet no one thought of running away. It was essential that everything be over by the next day, that triumph be on one side or the other, that the insurrection be a revolution or a mere skirmish. The government understood this, and so did the different parties. The least significant bourgeois felt it. Whence a feeling of anguish that melded with the impenetrable shadow of this quartier where all would be decided. Whence a redoubling of anxiety around this silence from which only a catastrophe would emerge. Only one sound could be heard there, a sound as heart-rending as a death-rattle, as menacing as a curse, the tocsin of Saint-Mély. Nothing was as blood-curdling as the clamor of this wild and desperate bell, wailing in the dark. As often happens, nature seemed to have come to terms with what men were about to do. Nothing disturbed the deadly harmonies of this whole. The stars had gone out. Heavy clouds filled the horizon all around with their melancholy billowing. There was a black sky over those dead streets, as though an immense pall had unfurled over that immense grave. While a battle still entirely political was brewing in that same spot that had already seen so many revolutionary events, while youth, secret societies, schools, in the name of principles, and the middle class, in the name of vested interests, approached each other to go head to head, to tear into each other and knock each other down, while each one was rushing and calling the final decisive hour of the crisis, beyond that fatal quartier, far away, in the deepest depths of the unfathomable cavities of the old, desperately down-and-out Paris that is disappearing under the splendor of the happy, opulent Paris, the somber voice of the people could be heard, roaring dully. A frightening and sacred voice combining the bellowing of the brute and the word of God that terrifies the weak and warns the wise, coming both from below like the voice of a lion and from above like the voice of thunder at one and the same time. The extreme edge. Marius had reached Les Halles. Everything here was even calmer, darker, and stiller than in the neighboring streets. You would have said that the icy peace of the tomb had seeped up from the ground and spread out under the sky. A red glare, though, carved out against this black backdrop the high rooftops of the houses that blocked off the Rue de la Chanvrerie on the Saint-Eustache side. This was the reflection of the torch burning in the Corinthe barricade. Marius headed for that red glare. It brought him to the Marché aux Poirées, and he could just see the dark mouth of the Rue des Prêcheurs. He went in. The insurgent scout, keeping watch at the other end, did not notice him. He felt himself to be very close to what he had come for, and he tiptoed forward. In this way, he reached the elbow of that short arm of the Rue Mondétour, which was, you will recall, the only connection to the outside that Enjolras had kept open. At the corner of the last house, on his left, he poked his head around and looked down this stretch of Rue Mondétour. A bit past the black corner where the little street met the Rue de la Chanvrerie, which threw a broad patch of shadow in which he himself was buried, he saw a glimmer of light on the cobblestones, part of the tavern, and, behind it, a paper lantern twinkling in a sort of amorphous wall and men crouching down with guns resting on their knees. All this was only 10 yards away. It was the inside of the barricade. The houses lining the lane on the right hid from him the rest of the tavern, the main barricade, and the flag. Marius had only one more step to take, so the unhappy young man sat down on a curbstone, folded his arms, and thought about his father. He thought about the heroic Colonel Pontmercy, who had been such a proud soldier, who had defended the frontier of France under the Republic and reached the frontier of Asia under the Emperor, who had seen Genoa, Alexandria, Milan, Turin, Madrid, Vienna, Dresden, Berlin, Moscow, who had left on all Europe's fields of victory drops of that same blood that he, Marius, had in his veins, who had gone grey before his time due to the rigours of discipline and command, who had lived with his sword belt buckled, his epaulettes falling on his breast, his cockade blackened by gunpowder, his forehead creased by his helmet, in barracks, in camps, in bivouacs, in ambulances, and who, 20 years later, had come back from the great wars with his cheek scarred, a smile on his face, unaffected, at peace, admirable, as pure of heart as a child, having given his all for France and done nothing against her. He told himself that his day had come now, too, that his hour had finally sounded, that, following in his father's footsteps, he too, brave, fearless, bold, would run in front of bullets, offer his chest to bayonets, shed his blood, seek out his enemy, seek death, that he in turn would wage war and enter onto the field of battle. But that the field of battle he was about to enter was the street, and that the war he was about to wage was civil war. He saw civil war yawning open like an abyss before him, and he knew that it was there that he would fall. And a shiver ran down his spine. He thought about his father's sword that his grandfather had sold to a second-hand dealer, and that he himself had so sorely missed. He told himself that it had done the right thing, that chaste and valiant sword, in escaping from his clutches and going off in anger into the dark. That if it had fled like that, it was because it was smart and could foresee the future. It was because it had a foreboding of the riot, the war of the gutters, the war of the cobblestones, the fusillades through cellar windows, all the stabbing in the back. It was because, coming from Marengo and Friedland, it did not want to go to the Rue de la Chanvrerie. It was because all that it had done with the father, it would not do with the son. He told himself that if he had collected that particular sword from his dead father's bedside, and dared to bring it with him for this struggle between French compatriots on a street corner under cover of night, it would most certainly have burned his hands and burst into flame in front of him like the sword of the angel. He told himself that he was happy that it was not there, that it had disappeared, that this was good, that this was only right, that his grandfather had been the true keeper of his father's flame, and that it was better that the colonel's sword had been sold to the highest bidder, sold to a junk dealer tossed among old scrap iron, rather than to cause the flank of his homeland to bleed today. And then he began to cry bitter tears. It was horrible. But what could he do? Live without Cosette he could not. Since she had gone away, there was nothing left for him to do but die. Had he not given her his word of honor that he would die? She had gone away, knowing that, which meant she liked the idea of his dying. And anyway, it was clear she no longer loved him, since she had gone away like that without a word of warning, without a letter, even though she knew his address. What was the good of living? What was there to live for now? And anyway, for God's sake, how could he come this far only to turn back? How could he come so close to danger only to run away? How could he come to stare into the barricade only to slink off all a-tremble, saying, "Actually, I've had enough of this. I've seen it. That's enough. It's civil war. I'll be on my way." How abandon his friends who were waiting for him, who perhaps needed him, who were a mere handful against an entire army? How drop everything at once, love, friendship, his word, to give his cowardice the excuse of patriotism? But this was impossible, and if his father's ghost were there in the shadows and saw him recoil, he would whip his backside with the flat of his sword and shout at him, "On you go, coward!" In the grip of his seesawing thoughts, he hung his head. All of a sudden, he lifted it again. A sort of dazzling adjustment had just been effected in his mind. The mind expands when you are close to the grave. To be close to death makes you see things as they really are. The vision of action that he perhaps felt he was about to throw himself into appeared to him no longer woeful but superb. The street war was suddenly transfigured by some unknowable interior labor of the soul before the eye of his mind. All the tumultuous question marks of his reverie came thronging back to him, but without troubling him in the slightest. He did not leave one of them unanswered. Let's see, why would his father be outraged? Aren't there any cases where insurrection achieves the dignity of duty? What would be demeaning?